Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Behind the Scenes. We welcome you back after our what has become a yearly summer break, at least. Coming up on today's show, we'll have an interview with Erica Strum Silberstein, the president of Wine Enthusiast Commerce. Now, Wine Enthusiast began as a commerce company, but then kind of became also a content creation company surrounding not only their magazine, which is fairly well known in the space, but also various types of video content as well. Erica will discuss kind of the line between commerce and content creation, how one hand has helped the other, and why they try, in certain circumstances, to keep those two things separate within the Wine Enthusiast Company. We'll also discuss Tractor Supply Company in our Looking Ahead segment. And in news, we discuss a retailer we've never talked about before on the podcast, in Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory, that very sweet mall staple. Well, a quick reminder that you can like us, rate us, however you access us on any podcast listening service. If you enjoy our show, those ratings do help others to find us. Also, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. Now, if you haven't subscribed yet, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. We've got 4 weeks coming up of just fantastic interviews. We'll talk to Rod Sides of Deloitte this coming week regarding back-to-school sales, what they're seeing from both consumers and retailers. We're going to talk retail security, something that we haven't discussed a whole lot of on the show in the past. And we're going to discuss how small towns are attempting to drive traffic to retail stores that might not be chain related, might be a little bit aside from that buy online, pick up in store, or e-commerce type retail that we've been discussing since the beginning of the pandemic. So, as we mentioned, we begin with Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory. Again, retailer and parcel service food establishment, usually found within various malls and such throughout the country. Of course, you're going to find various ready-to-eat food in them, but also gift sets and the like. And we're really looking at their earnings release from this past week, just a few days ago, in fact, for a few things. First, what are they seeing regarding traffic at the factory outlet malls and traditional malls where they take residence? And then second, what are their sales looking like? And what's their future as a mall staple that's kind of one of these small square footage stores, not one of these mall anchors that we hear talked about? And I think that's why it's important to look at retailers such as this, because their average square footage running right around 1,000 square feet. Of that, only about 650 feet of that sellable space. So these are smaller mall retailers. They are really dependent on the success of the shopping centers, of the shopping malls themselves. They do have locations in certain downtown areas and certain street front areas, but for the most part, I think people know them as a mall retailer. And so I think looking at Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory gives us an idea as to overall mall health. And we should keep in mind, too, that unlike something like clothing, where people going back to work now, kind of refreshing their wardrobe, everything at Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory is a discretionary purchase. There's nothing there that you absolutely need or want. It's a matter of people treating themselves, ultimately feeling as though they have that extra discretionary income if they do shop there. Now, first, let's talk a little bit about the company, since it is one we haven't addressed in the past on the show. As I mentioned time and again, most listeners are probably aware of where they take residence, but the company does break down their stores into 4 subsets: factory outlets, tourist areas, regional malls, and street fronts. And they're not only in line at malls and such, but they do have kiosks as well. Those were introduced in 2002. Generally, you're looking at everything condensed into about 250 square feet at those kiosks. Now, the company itself was incorporated in 1982, started in 1981. They're celebrating their 40th anniversary this year. They currently have a mix of company-owned and franchise stores. By and large, though, you are looking at franchise stores. Again, they sell mostly chocolate, confections. However, they also dabble in the frozen yogurt category or the froyo category for those cool people out there as well. And they serve as a manufacturer of the goods that they sell. So vertical integration. In other words, they also have licensing agreements with various entities outside of the United States to set up shop there. Their largest non-network customer is actually Edible Arrangements. So Edible Arrangements kind of leads in terms of sales outside of their retail store. Sales to Edible Arrangements accounted actually for 6.4% of Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory's overall revenues this quarter. In fact, and that number was nearly double during the same period last year, of course, during the heart of pandemic buying, with Edible Arrangements kind of available there to fulfill more of those non-store sales. So overall, total of 333 stores in operation as of the conclusion of the period covered by this earnings call, which would be May 30th. And they have a presence in 37 states, along with internationally South Korea, Qatar, Panama, and the Philippines. And finally, one last note, and this from someone that lives in Colorado, certainly I think is noteworthy because a lot of people hear Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory, they probably think Denver, maybe even my home of Colorado Springs. They're actually headquartered in Durango, Colorado, which is in the southwest corner of the state, no less beautiful than those other locations, certainly, but they are located quite a ways away, in fact, from Denver and Colorado Springs and the rest of the Front Range. Now, as for their earnings, they issued a boilerplate statement at the beginning of their release, noting that there are still a lot of restrictions in place regarding their operations throughout the world. However, they did note that both their corporate stores and franchise stores were seeing an uptick in demand. At the very least, some franchise stores at least seeing demand even with where it was prior to the pandemic. But generally speaking, they're seeing greater demand than pre-pandemic, despite the fact that these restrictions remain in place in many of their locations. Now, they did measure their numbers quarter over quarter. And again, this quarter ending at the end of May of 2020 versus the end of May of 2021. As such, you look last year's quarter, almost entirely composed of pandemic conditions, maybe just a couple of weeks of non-pandemic sales at the beginning of that in some of their markets. As a company, they saw an uptick in revenue by 181%. It's actually a little bit greater than what we've seen from a lot of clothing retailers, a lot of apparel retailers, a lot of other mall-based retailers. Still seeing triple digits, just lower triple digits than 181%. Still, their revenue figures came in at just $7.6 million versus a paltry $2.7 million during 2020. Again, that's not reflective of overall sales at the company because those are mostly franchise fees and the like due to the fact that these locations are franchised. Now, this resulted in a bottom line shift from a loss of $4.8 million last year in this quarter. And that's a lot, keep in mind, for a company that's only bringing in $7.6 million in what they considered to be a good quarter in this most recent quarter, to a net income of $580,000 in this quarter in 2021. Now, what they call factory sales did see a bump as well. That saw a 136% increase. This was fueled primarily by a 281% increase in product sales to their franchised and licensed stores as they begin to restock and get things rolling again post-pandemic, or at least post-pandemic in most of the United States. I know there's some areas in the Midwest that are seeing an increase in cases that really hasn't been seen since, this past winter. Now, all that being said, they did see, Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory did, an 11.7% decrease in direct-to-consumer sales, presumably because the customers that they were selling direct to online were going back to the retail stores themselves. And more than balancing out this 11.7% decrease in that direct-to-consumer category, comps at their U.S. franchise locations were up 14%, not over last year, over 2019, over pre-COVID. And that is a substantial increase in something that we are seeing across the board in terms of mall based retailers. We're seeing this double digit increase over 2 years ago as people being emboldened, people wanting to get out. They might be tired of just ordering things online. They want to get back out to the shopping malls. This is what this number is telling us, basically. These factory outlets, these storefront type stores or inline type stores in downtown areas for Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory, their indoor traditional mall locations, all doing very well compared to where they were 2 years ago, which has to mean positive things, at least for the rest of the mall retailers, because as I mentioned, people don't go to a mall for Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory. They shop at Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory as a consequence of having gone to the mall for other things. So I think positive signs, certainly, for the rest of mall-based retail, at least good and differentiated mall-based retail. Some future notes, as far as the company is concerned, perhaps the most worrisome statement arising from the call was of a, and I quote, disagreement between Edible Arrangements and Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory. I say call, really more of a release, as they don't have calls any longer. But since we're more concerned about their retail aspect than their wholesale operations, we'll kind of keep coverage of this short. They said the disagreement centered around e-commerce and their overall alliance. Most worrisome, they have no results so far, and that past sales to Edible Arrangements should not be factored into future projections. So not all positive on this call. Additionally, this isn't their only issue with regard to a third party. They noted that during the summer, they initiated legal proceedings against Immaculate Confections, which was the operator of their Canadian locations. This came after their agreement with Immaculate Confections expired in June 2021. That was an agreement, by the way, initiated originally in 1991, so it had been going on for 30 years. Apparently, Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory is alleging that Immaculate Confections has used logo and branding and intellectual property to its benefit in the intervening time. And again, you hate to see something like this because, as we've talked about before on the show, the only beneficiaries here, usually the lawyers. It's usually we see where both companies tend to lose in a situation like this. Again, the takeaway from this, traffic surrounding their wheelhouse locations seem to be picking up. And once again, we get some positive reinforcement that mall traffic is on the upswing as people are breaking free from their homes. If you can take anything from our coverage of Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory today, I think that would be the thing to take. Well, coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Erica Strum Silverstein, the president of Wine Enthusiast Commerce. We'll talk to her about the intersection between content and subscriber-based content with commerce. We'll also talk to her a little bit about their overall commerce operations, which are interesting, a lot of bespoke merchandise, and we'll talk to her about how they underscore the idea of trust with their consumers, especially as it pertains to some of the luxury goods they're selling through their commerce channels. Content creation is a term that has become a bit of a buzzword over the past few years in business, yet as it pertains to retail, what we now term as content creators in the forms of magazines, newspapers, and other subscriber-based content has long intersected with commerce. And here to discuss this intersection, the development of the two fields in concert, and the current state of retail as it pertains to media is Erica Strum Silverstein, the president of Wine Enthusiast Commerce. Wine Enthusiast began as a commerce company before growing into a content creator and a multi-channel marketer addressing the wholesale, retail, and consumer direct markets. Erica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Trent. I'm really, really happy to be here.
All right. So I was wondering if you could provide a brief explanation, maybe a brief exploration into the history of Wine Enthusiast as a company, because I know it's a family business. I know it's a family-oriented business. So if you could give us a peek maybe into the last 30 or 40 years as far as Wine Enthusiast is concerned.
Sure, absolutely. So I am the second generation. Wine Enthusiast was founded by my parents, Adam and Sybil Strum. They founded the business basically right after they got married, and they sort of noticed there was a lack of companies providing all the products that people need to enjoy wine. At that time, wine was pretty intimidating to most customers. They enjoyed it themselves. My dad was actually a salesperson for Gallo. And so that's how he got into wine. His father was also a wine salesperson. And they always enjoyed wine with dinner. And they sort of thought, you know, there needs to be a solution for this. We need to get corkscrews, glassware, wine cellars in the hands of people more easily. And they also wanted to make wine accessible and approachable to people. Wine was very intimidating, sort of an elite activity, and they really wanted to kind of make wine something that every single person could enjoy because they enjoyed it themselves and they wanted to spread that. So they had an entrepreneurial spirit, as they do now very much still, and they never ever shied from hard work. I remember being a little girl and, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and seeing my parents feverishly working on all the orders that had come in. So they started with a catalog. That was the early days of the business. They founded it from the attic of our house, and they mailed a print catalog, just a few pages, with a few products that they thought people really needed to enjoy wine to the fullest. The business started to grow. We expanded out of the house into an office, and this was in the early 80s. And from that office, moved to a larger office, opened a distribution center, and we've grown to 3 or 4 new locations since 1979. But of course, we are not just taking paper orders anymore, though we are still really, really big with phone. We have over 50% of our orders now, of course, coming in from e-commerce. But we still feel that personal touch is really important. It never goes out of style. So the phone is still a very big driver of our revenue. And now we have multiple fulfillment locations. We're looking to expand even more to get products to people faster. And we are coming off a record year of growth of 2020 because it was, of course, such a big year for home furnishings companies, which is really what we are on the commerce side. And it has gotten much more competitive. So 1979, we were the only player, and now you can get a corkscrew, you know, at the grocery store or most big box retailers. But we look to do it better, and we look to partner with all the new providers that there are. And we see that as a good thing, because the more accessible wine is to people, the more people will raise their hand and want to drink wine, which helps wine enthusiasts as well. And we hope that it helps people's everyday lives to relax at the end of the day with a delicious beverage.
So coming from that, honestly, and a lot of longtime listeners know this, but I once worked in spirits retail. My first exposure to Wine Enthusiast as a company was actually through the magazine, because the retailer I worked with subscribed to the magazine, that type of thing. And I'm kind of curious, because we talked about it starting with that catalog concept. It eventually started to develop into something a little bit more magazine-like, certainly. What's the company's philosophy overall regarding not only the balance between content creation and, of course, the commerce side of things, but also as far as providing information to prospective purchasers of this equipment, trying not to overstep as far as any conflict of interest is concerned as well?
Absolutely. Well, the businesses are really quite separate. And when we put out content, we don't look at it as an immediate driver towards commerce at all. They're quite separate. But we do feel that if we provide people with information and utility, then we'll be top of mind when they do decide that they want to raise their hand and buy a wine cellar or a new set of glasses. So there's really no hard sell. But I would say that the content does help us find all those folks that do want to get into wine. So it is symbiotic, even though they are very separate, completely different teams, completely different financial statements. So they help each other, but they're completely their own business. We do build a lot of content just for commerce itself. And I'd say that's centered on two things. One would be customer curiosity. So what does the customer need or want to know? And for that, we're really, really big on SEO, as you know, most retailers have to be. But we're constantly looking at what people are searching, what questions do they have, so that we have the answers for them. Number two, we're always thinking about how do we bring our products to life in an authentic way. We recently did a bit of soul searching and came up with a new mission statement, which is we bring wine to life. So we're trying to get away a little bit from having models and really staged photography. We're trying to work with influencers and even our customers getting user-generated content so that people see our products in use in daily life, not some perfect polished experience, but something fun. You know, we want to see people's wine cellars with their dogs. We want to see things that aren't 100% perfect or conventional, because that's really what makes wine fun and enjoyable. We never want it to be stuffy.
So we've talked about a few different things now. Of course, SEO, top of mind awareness as it pertains to, of course, the retail portion or the catalog portion, if you will, of Wine Enthusiast. And I'm kind of curious because you mentioned you're seeking different distribution methods as far as getting product in customers' hands sooner. And of course, that's the big question kind of hovering over all e-commerce retailers, if you will. In terms of the near future, is a foray into brick and mortar potentially in the works? Is it going to be predominantly digital with different fulfillment centers? Kind of what does the immediate future hold without giving away, of course, any company secrets for Wine Enthusiast?
Of course, no problem. That's a great question. So it's a little bit backwards. It's kind of a funny time to be talking about opening brick and mortar, but we have been giving it some thought. And the reason is wine cellars are a big investment for most people. You can get something really small and start with 6 bottles, you know, for $100. But a lot of the big sellers are $2,000-$3,000, some even as much as $10,000. And we want to make sure people are making the right choice. It's not that different than buying a car. When you buy a car, though, I know you can buy a car online. I still see a lot of busy dealerships these days. People want to touch and feel a car before they buy it. And a wine cellar is really the same. How do they know how important the shelving is to them, the spacing, what lighting they prefer, unless they see it in person? So we've done a lot with imagery. We've done a lot, like I mentioned, the phone channel to bring our products closer to people, but it's really hard to replace that in-store experience. So we are thinking about it. And the two reasons would be that personal experience and also the fact that it does take a little while to decide to actually make the investment in a wine cellar. We're pretty big on looking at all the attribution modeling of our orders. And what we see is people have 6 or 7 touches between our marketing channels before they make a purchase. So it's a pretty long selling cycle. And that's why we think potentially brick and mortar could make sense for us at the next frontier.
One other thing I noticed too when perusing the e-commerce website is that in terms of a wine cellar, there are design consultations that you offer, that type of thing. How does that work in terms of kind of like trying to bridge the gap, maybe over the phone with someone regarding outfitting a wine cellar, regarding feeling out where they're at in terms of the whole process beyond installing that?
So people will talk to a customer for as long as they like, and I love to pride ourselves on that. So even if you're not ready to make a purchase, or if you even just want to talk to us about your wine collection, God love them, our team will stay on the phone and give advice. We try to get a lot of information up front because so much depends on the space you have, and we will design or help you select a wine cellar for any space. We've had people convert a bathroom to a wine cellar. We've done beautiful installations under staircases. So they usually want to know things like where the power source is, the square footage of the room. If you're building something custom with racking and such, we use an architectural program to really 3D build out what the room could be. But we also have all different needs of customers. Some people just want somewhere to put a really large collection, and they don't want fancy bells and whistles, but they want something really large that will fit like 300, 400 bottles, more of a utility thing. We ask where they're putting it, that's really key, and where they live. So if someone lives in Texas or Arizona, we know there's no chance this cellar should go in their garage, right? Because that's basically like putting it outside. The wine's going to get heated up because the temperature around the cellar is important, that the cellar can do a lot to mitigate, but you don't want to have a wine cellar outside. So we ask a lot about customer needs, a location, the size of the space, those types of things. Do they want lighting? Do they have kids? Maybe they want a lock. We get that a lot.
So it's easy, of course, to build consumer confidence when you get a chance to talk with them over the phone. You get a chance to ask these questions. You get a chance to convey the fact that, hey, you really are experts when it comes to wine, wine accessories, wine cellars. But your website, I do want to point this out, not every product on the Wine Enthusiast e-commerce site is a premium price product, but many are in the premium category or luxury, if you will. What are some of the ways in which you've endeavored to just kind of build that consumer confidence as they're shopping some of these premium or some of these luxury high-end products on the site?
Sure. So in addition to those phone calls, and I should mention that even if you place an order online and never touch the phone or live chat, you will actually get a phone call from one of our team members, whether you like it or not. You can choose to not answer, but we always make sure to follow up and just double check that you bought the right product. But in addition to that, we try to put absolutely a ton of information, specs, guides. We try more and more to shoot video and really highlighting what I mentioned earlier, the user-generated content. So that's been a big push this year because we can take tremendous photography, but people want to see what it looks like in a real person's house. So really kind of bringing that authenticity to light and trying to anticipate every question before it's asked. So we do have a Q&A question, a Q&A area where customers can ask any questions about the product before they buy it, if they don't want to get on the phone. We do have live chat, like I mentioned, and we are going to be adding texting, which has become so, so big. So I'd say just making sure we're there with our expertise any step of the way. And if you know what you want, you can absolutely place an order and not talk to anybody, and that's perfectly fine. But if people have questions, as they often do with a considered purchase, we want to make sure that we're there.
You mentioned video, you mentioned obviously the imagery that's on the website. Is that a circumstance where maybe it kind of helped the e-commerce site out for Wine Enthusiast as a company, separate, although the branches might be, to have kind of that background in mass media and content creation and the like?
I think so, because our media team, you know, they're really industry experts. They're talking to sommeliers, they're talking to restaurateurs, they're talking to grape growers, they're talking to some of the titans of the industry who are making the trends. But I really feel that it's so important that we also stay grounded and talk to everyday customers. So in the years that come, you know, as my sister and I partner in taking the business forward, I really feel like we have to connect those dots. And we're really the only brand, you know, in the wine space that has both that customer expertise and industry expertise.
So looking forward, we've talked a little bit about, you know, the potential for brick and mortar, the potential for more distribution centers or fulfillment centers throughout the country. Kind of a 30,000 foot view, what does the future hold for Wine Enthusiast over the next, oh, maybe 5 to 10 years?
It's interesting because my parents founded the business with a mission to make wine accessible to all, but I still feel like there's a lot of work to be done. I would love people to be able to talk about wine with the same confidence that they talk about food. So this is an analogy that my sister raised with me. So if I asked you, Trent, you know, what's your favorite food? You could so easily answer it, I bet, you know, whether it be cheese, chocolate, or whatever it is, you can answer it in a second. You don't have to think about it. And we find that when people are asked, which wine do you like? There is this insecurity. Even people in the industry, they caveat it with, well, I'm not an expert, or there's so much more to know. So our reach goal at the company is for everyone to just be confident in what they want to drink. So we have our tremendously huge and important wine ratings program on the media side, where the editors are tasting thousands of wines every year. But I really view that as a guide. So the best wine is the one that you like. And I would really love to see more people being confident and just thinking of wine as a beverage, just like anything else. And I believe that ultimately that will help the commerce business too, because more people will need all the accoutrements that come with wine. And so that's kind of like a reach goal. But in the day-to-day business world of running the company, I think it's just going to be demonstrating more flexibility, payment options, locations. We're shipping from people expect the best. Companies can no longer, you know, blame the pandemic for long wait times and things like that. So we've just had to get so much better. We have a lot of big investments of technology in the pipeline for the next few years. So I think that's really the vision, is making wine accessible to all, bringing wine to life, making sure people enjoy it without intimidation, and making sure our experience is absolutely best of breed when people buy from us.
Some fantastic insight there about the industry. My personal answers would be snow peas and Malbecs. So,
Snow peas, that's a cool favorite food.
So if anyone out there wants to come at me about either one, feel free. But Erica, I really do appreciate you taking time to join us here on the podcast today. It's been fun.
Thank you so much.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Erica once again for joining us. And if you want to check out their online catalog, you can do so at wineenthusiast.com. You can kind of see some of the things that Erica was talking about, not only in terms of photography, product photography, but also some of that user-generated content she was discussing as well. So if you're not familiar with Wine Enthusiast, it is kind of an interesting perusal. It's a very clean website. My favorite part of the website, because I'm easily entertained, is the fact that when you click on something and the page is loading, your mouse turns into a little swirling wine glass. But again, I'm easily amused in that way. Well, it's time for our Looking Ahead segment, and I'm looking ahead at Tractor Supply Company. You know, we've talked quite a bit over the last couple of years about home improvement retail, especially during the pandemic, really ticking up. The reason I'm looking ahead at this is Tractor Supply Company was projecting sales to be somewhat tepid after last year. And the other thing is, a lot of analyst consensus estimates figured that sales in the farm and home sector might not be up all that much. In fact, looking at least fact set consensus estimates, they expect to see same store sales decline 1.9% coming into this earnings call for Tractor Supply. I'm interested to see, you know, Tractor Supply is a company on the whole with a lot of momentum, but a lot of the companies that have come out of the 1 year anniversary of the pandemic a little bit bearish about comp sales, they're seeing positive surprises. And I think this is an intriguing area as a whole to watch, because not only is Tractor Supply one of the few publicly traded companies in this space where we actually get to see numbers, whereas we don't for the likes of Fleet Farm or Rural King or Big R, and you can go on and on with the various companies and various square footages that they all have throughout the country. But farm and home was something that really saw an uptick during the pandemic. People were growing their own fruits and vegetables. People were investing time, energy, and space into their properties. Those that have land scaled up some of their animal husbandry workings, if you will. A lot of people bought chicks for eggs. A lot of people bought various types of farm animals. We know, of course, about the adoption rates for dogs and cats. Obviously, that's going to benefit Tractor Supply Company in theory as well. They also own PetSense, but sell a decent amount of pet products at their full line stores. So all of that is a reason I'm looking ahead to this, because is that stopping in 2021? I don't think so personally, but we'll get a view through this earnings call of what the spring seasonal season looked like in many of their markets. I'm anticipating that it's going to be mildly positive, I think, for Tractor Supply Company. I think people got hooked on the whole kind of do-it-yourself, investing once again in their yards, in their properties last year. I anticipate seeing a bit more of that this year than you might have seen in 2019, but it'll remain to be seen as to where things come in for Tractor Supply Company. And again, this is a company that we talk about, you know, basically once a year, maybe twice a year on the podcast, but they have a lot of things going on in terms of other partnerships as well. One of the stories we recently covered with them was their partnership with Carhartt, and I'd be interested to see what comments they make on the call this coming week for that as well. So that is the story we're looking ahead to. Once again, next week, we'll be joined by Rod Sides of Deloitte. We will talk about their annual back-to-school and back-to-college survey. We don't want to ignore the college subset of retail, both what consumers expect to spend and how retailers are responding to that, how retailers are dealing with supply chain issues as it pertains to back-to-school, and whether that's trickled down to the cadence of buying for consumers as well. So it's a jam-packed interview, as it always is, with Rod, and when he joins us on the show, we're looking forward to that. Well, thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back with you approximately 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.